From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. This week, painter Justin Vining takes on a big project. Bob Harbin wants to see more of you. And where would you like to wake up tomorrow? And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of this and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, behind the scenes at the IMA's new Portraits of Our City exhibit. Right now, though, during the Civil War, many U.S. military members got tattoos paying homage to their experiences. Whether it was a flag, a battle date, or an anchor, these markings helped soldiers express social solidarity with one another. Though tattooing became a taboo in civilian life shortly after the end of World War I, its significance remained a cornerstone of military life. Now, a new IUPUI interdisciplinary project showcases veterans' tattoos and the stories behind them. Students from the Heron School of Art and Design are taking photos, while English department students help tell the stories of the men and women who serve their country. The show, Military Tattoos at IUPUI, opens November 9th in the Campus Center Cultural Arts Gallery. The project happened because IUPUI's Director of Veterans and Military Personnel, Kim Bloodgood, was inspired by a similar exhibit at the Indianapolis Arts Center organized by Paul Richard, Vice President of Veterans in Industries and Arts. I invited Kim and Creative Co-Director Shelby Flora to tell me about putting together the exhibit. So, Kim, I want to start with you. How did you first encounter the idea of this exhibit?
Well, last year during Veterans Day, I went to the Indianapolis Arts Center, and they had an exhibit, a military tattoo exhibit, and I saw it. I walked over to the person in charge, and I said, "Can I have this exhibit for my school?"
Ah. And the answer was?
Of course.
Artists are good that way, aren't they?
Yes, ma'am.
And as director of the Office for Veterans and Military Personnel, you have access to a lot of veterans. How many veterans are affiliated with IUPUI, ballpark?
Well, I can kind of give you actual numbers. There's about 1,088 receiving GI Bill benefits. Then there's another 350-plus that are students not receiving GI Bill benefits that are veterans. We have over 350 employees that are veterans.
Wow.
And then we have well over 785 children of disabled veterans with using benefits.
So. That's a big universe. So you wanted the idea of the exhibit, but you wanted, obviously, to use your own personnel. So how did you get the word out that you were looking for people to be photographed for the exhibit?
Oh, several different ways. So in order to reach the faculty and staff, I sent a message through our Veteran Faculty Staff Council. We got several faculty and staff that are involved with this project in that respect. And then for the students, we've just been doing numerous things, putting it out on Facebook, sending it through the listserv. When they come in and we see that they have tattoos, we kind of talk them into it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's such a variety of ways in order to get the students involved.
Shelby, as a creative director and one of the two photographers and a person who has her own ink, it seems like you're qualified, but... Did you have any thoughts about, wow, what do I know about military service, or what did you do to kind of prepare yourself to photograph veterans with tattoos?
I do have some family that have been in the military, and that already like made me kind of familiar at least with the military. And then the way we photographed them was to be as, you know, like, unified as possible. And
what does that mean?
So we, in the portraiture, we're gonna keep it black and white, and we're going to do a massive piece that resembles the American flag. And then for the tattoo portion, we purposefully shot everyone on this really pretty red backdrop to make sure it was flattering to all, like, skin tones and everything. I prepared myself, I guess, that
way. Yeah, yeah. Fascinating stuff. And were you surprised, and this is a question for both of you, were you surprised by any of the subject matter of the ink that you discovered or have been discovering on this journey?
Well, I can kind of say yes. We have someone that comes in, makes herself very well known. I did not have a clue that she had a tattoo. And when she showed it to me, it was on her abdomen. Mm-hmm. And when she showed it to me, it just surprised me because obviously, I guess you could say, I didn't expect her to have a tattoo. Most people wouldn't expect me to have a tattoo, and mm-hmm. I have one mm-hmm. or two. But that I think that's where it was more surprising than actually the content of the tattoo itself.
Hmm.
Right. Yeah, I agree. There were some people that you would walk in and you would have no idea that they would have tattoos. Some of them even had full leg tattoos and stuff like that you wouldn't see, obviously, under them wearing jeans or pants. And I think that just shows how tattoos are becoming more accepted and a lot more people have them nowadays than I guess they used to.
Tell me about the oldest subject who's part of this exhibit. You had some World War II vets who came to be photographed?
We had some older. I'm not sure
or maybe
if they're
Korea.
As old as World War II. I know at least Korean War. They are faculty. At least the one that I'm thinking of, he is a faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
He was a colonel. And he teaches, I think he teaches biology or anatomy. He teaches anatomy.
Mm.
So very kind gentleman, very caring, very giving to the veteran universe, and just was right up there giving us that yes, I will do this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People surely must have become emotional telling you the stories or just showing you their artwork. Did you ever have any moments where you're like, whoa, this is intense?
For the most part, everyone, we just carried on some like small talk and it was really comfortable with everyone. There were a few people that kind of talked to me more in depth about some of their tattoos. And yeah, there were some, you know, really like funny or cool stories, I guess. But there were also some sad ones. There were a few. It does get pretty intense because a lot of their tattoos mean a lot to them.
Mm-hmm.
And me having my own, I understand that also.
Mm-hmm. So. I imagine some were in memory of friends who didn't make it back from service.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. There were a couple of those, so.
Kim, this is for you as a veteran. What would you want people who've never served to think about as they come to see this exhibit?
That we're all individuals. We are all different. But we all sign that dotted line saying that we would serve regardless of what would happen to us.
Kim Bloodgood is IUPUI's Director of Veterans and Military Personnel, and Shelby Flora is one of two student photographers behind the creation of military tattoos at IUPUI. It opens November 9th with a reception in the Cultural Arts Gallery in the Campus Center and runs through January 6th. What can a photographic portrait tell us about a person? What can you learn from someone by asking him or her a single question? What can the dreams of a city's residents tell us about that city? The Indianapolis Museum of Art's new Portraits of Our City discusses these questions through hundreds of black and white photographs of local residents, plus a sound installation featuring hundreds of our citizens answering the question, "Where would you like to wake up tomorrow?" Our colleague Melissa Davis was part of the crew for the sound design, and she invited Assistant Director of Photography Tasha Horwitz to talk about the exhibit's goal of discovering the soul of our city. Let's talk about this brand new exhibit at the IMA. What is Portraits of Our City all about?
So it's really a community portrait project. We went out into the city to 8 locations. We photographed 450 Indianapolis residents. The only requirements for participation were being over 18 and being living in the Indy area. And the exhibition will display all of the portraits and also play an audio reel with answers to each participant's question. We asked each person the same question, and we selected some of our favorite answers and put those together.
And as you said, your team took portraits at sites throughout Indianapolis this summer. Mm-hmm. How were the sites selected?
Well, really, at its core, this project is about building community and making connections. And so when I was thinking through shooting locations, I was kind of trying to approach it from that perspective as well. So I reached out to a few community organizations and just explained the project and asked them if they would host us. So we worked with Ivy Tech, Indy Parks, the new transit center. So we worked with Indigo, just several groups throughout the city.
Having viewed the portraits, they're amazing. And they capture the spirit of people. And these are normal folks, normal people. And everyone looks beautiful.
And that's what we keep saying, too. It's amazing. You know, people would walk by and you wouldn't necessarily be struck by them. And then they'd get in front of the camera and their faces are amazing. And it's really effective asking people this question. And I sat for a portrait, not as part of the project, but just for fun afterwards. And I found the same thing happening to me once. I don't like having my picture taken. I get very uncomfortable in front of the camera. But once Eric, who's our senior photographer, who was the lead photographer on this project, asked me the question, I kind of forgot that I was having my portrait taken. And I started thinking about it and answering it. And it just kind of does transport you. And it worked.
And the exhibit combines audio, sort of that public radio style of storytelling,
yes.
with these beautiful portraits. How was that question selected?
So the question, which is, where would you wish to wake up tomorrow? It's actually borrowed from a project that I love. This project, gosh, in some ways it was this collaborative effort because I drew inspiration from so many other projects that I love. And many of them were public radio projects. Not all of them were visual projects. But about 8 years ago, a project was started in New Orleans called 50 People, One Question. And since then, this project has become an international effort. It's a series of short films where they go into a city and they ask 50 people the same question. And they use video for it. And they've tried out several questions. And in the very beginning, they kind of had a core of three that they used. And this was one of those questions. And I loved it. I just felt like it was the perfect one for our project. And the creators of 50 People, One Question are really generous with their content. They say, take the elements of our project, be inspired by it, just give us credit. And so we borrowed their question.
It's a good question.
It is. It is. I wanted something that people wouldn't be intimidated by. I feel like if you ask the wrong question, people will try to give you the right answer, or they'll think too. If you ask someone like what their favorite anything is, they're gonna think about it, and they're gonna make sure that they give you an answer they feel good about. I wanted something that would elicit more of a just kind of off the cuff. The answer could something that your answer today could change for tomorrow, and that a lot of it's about where you are in that moment. And something that you would just kind of answer from the heart. And I felt like this was the right question for that.
And I think that's a good spot to listen to an excerpt of the audio from this project.
Where do I wish to wake up tomorrow? Tomorrow I like to wake up in the arms of my wife. That's where I wish to wake up. My wife's had a stroke, so I just want to be close to her. That's all. That's my wish, is to be close to her as much as possible. You know, she just turned 50, and I want 50 more years. I've been married 26, so.
Where do I wish to wake up tomorrow? I would want to wake up probably in Italy. Because it just seems so peaceful, and, like, I kind of like, because I don't know Italian, and I think it'd be cool to, like, wake up in a place that, like, you don't really, like, you're not comfortable where you are, and just, like, kind of explore and see new things, and...
Where would I wish? Well, for one, I wish to wake up alive on this side of the dirt, but, you know, this has been a good place. Indianapolis has been good. I don't mind waking up here at all, so, I mean, we could all say someplace that we've always dreamt of, but this has been a good city to live in, so I don't mind waking up here every day.
So we just heard from a participant from Portraits of Our City, and I was wondering, what or has anything surprised you about this project?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, honestly, I was excited about it, but I didn't realize how wonderful and rewarding and quite frankly fun the whole process of creating this project was going to be. It sounds a little cliche, but, you know, I say this project is about building community, and it really has been that every step of the way. So I think that's kind of, for me, the surprise. It's just that it really has been about making connections. It's really, yeah, in the ways that I had hoped, but in so many other ways that I didn't anticipate.
WFYI's Melissa Davis with Portraits of Our City's Assistant Director of Photography, Tasha Horowitz. Melissa was part of the sound design crew, and you can see and hear the exhibit beginning this coming Friday, October 27th, and it's up through July 29th. Learn more at discovernewfields.org. And if you renew your WFYI membership or become a new member, you might get to see and hear Portraits of Our City for free. We have a limited number of pairs of tickets, so if this interests you, navigate on over to WFYI.org/give and choose the tickets as your thank you gift.
And, you know, where would you like to wake up tomorrow? It sounds like the kind of question that all of our radio team asks every day. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and with the WFYI radio news team and our news coverage, our health coverage, state house coverage, arts coverage, we're always trying to find out what can make our city healthier, better informed, and happier. So whether it's hard news or something fun that you can see or do, we are dedicated to bringing you local news in a quick, convenient way. And if you come to depend on WFYI Radio, won't you renew your membership or become a member now? It's very easy. Just give us a call at 1-800-233-0020 or go to our safe and secure website, WFYI.org, and make your pledge right now.
And don't forget, hop on that task right away to claim tickets to Portraits of Our City. Once again, 1-800-233-0020 or WFYI.org. And stay tuned. There's lots more to come on The Art of the Matter. Just around the corner, Justin Vining paints his biggest work to date. But first, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Stephanie Drury of Sprouts, a cooking school for kids.
We're talking cooking today with Stephanie Drury of Sprouts Cooking School in Carmel. Stephanie, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, first of all, tell me about Sprouts. You know, when did you launch the business and why a cooking school for kids?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started Sprouts in 2015, and it was really inspired by my three children. I had always been cooking with them in my kitchen at home, and I wanted them to take cooking lessons. And so I had searched the internet. I could not find anything here locally. And it was about that time in my life, I think a lot of mothers go through that where they're looking for something else.
What's next?
Yeah, as your children grow. And I was in that stage. I had my degree in elementary education. And I thought my real passion is cooking, but also working with kids. Like, could I blend the two together? And there wasn't really anything like a company like mine at the time, but I just thought maybe if I went for it, something good could come of that. So I started with little cooking camps in a spare bedroom in my home.
Oh my
I turned
goodness.
This room into like a cooking studio.
Oh, that's great. Right in your house.
Yeah. I put like a single ad on Facebook. I think I could hold like 60 kids at the time. And within like a week or two, we were sold out for the summer. People were like messaging me saying that I can't get in. Do you have an in to get into the school? And I was like, well, maybe there is something there. And it's not just going to be for my friends.
So clearly a pent-up demand for this.
Yeah, I think that a lot of kids were probably watching it on Food Network.
Oh, absolutely.
And Chopped Junior.
Chopped Junior.
I think that that plays a large part in maybe their interest. And that's kind of how my kids were, too. They were like bombing the kitchen, not knowing like, you know, some basic, you know, I guess recipes or skills that they would need. So, but I guess that's part of it. And along with that, maybe they grew up with a mom or grandma that they had cooked with and just wanted to expand upon that knowledge. So
how did it grow then from the spare bedroom summer camp?
Mm-hmm. So about a year after we had started, I couldn't keep up with demand in the house. And so I didn't want there to be frustration from our customers that they, like anytime I released something, it would instantly sell out. And so I started teaching at the Monon Center in Carmel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was teaching there two classes a week. And I was also teaching out of my home several nights a week. And then also teenagers wanted to start cooking too. So then I was actually teaching them in my kitchen, the little kids in the spare bedroom, birthday parties on the weekends. And it just became so much on our family. In December of last year, we knew it was time. We were either going to have to grow or there's just no way to really stay the way we were anymore.
Right.
And so we signed a lease and opened a storefront.
Now walk me through how a class is. How do you handle all those kids and keeping them focused? Because I'm sure staying on task is a challenge.
Yes. So we, in our new space, we're able to divide them by age groups. So we have 3 through 5, 6 through 8, and 9 through 13. In our old space, all the kids were together. So now we have a fabulous teacher who is a preschool teacher, and she does our 3 through 5s and 6 through 8. She reads them stories if they need like a little brain break, because the 3 through 5 year olds can only do it for so long.
My goodness.
So we cook and then we read a little story that goes along with what we're talking about that day. Our 6 to 8 year olds, they're somewhere in the middle. So, you know, maybe we eat outside on our patio, and then that breaks it up. And our 9 through 13 year olds, they're on heat. They use real knives. And so they're really able to immerse themselves in that cooking experience, and they're fine. They could do it for a very long time.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2 The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and coming up, vaudeville or burlesque, anyone? Indianapolis artist Justin Vining's latest creation is colossal. The Butler Arts Center commissioned Vining to create a mural to hang in the lobby of Clues Memorial Hall for the next 2 years, and WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer went on site to check into it for us. So how big is this thing?
It's big.
Whoa.
It's multiple stories high. It just takes up all the space in Clues Hall, and it looks perfect in that space as well. And it's really an interesting story because Justin is really one of the city's busiest artists, but he managed to take 6 weeks this summer, and he creates this compelling scene. It involves the Indianapolis skyline and, of course, the Butler campus. So I met him in the lobby to see the work up close and to learn just a little bit more about this larger-than-life project.
Being 40 foot tall and 20 feet wide, the scale really lent itself to my older work that contained tons of movement and a lot of just unexpected abstracted elements that was very inspired by my time as an elementary school art teacher. And I was just kind of creating this abstract world that you could just sort of float and move around in that had city elements, farm elements, and just other unexpected elements in it.
Including the Butler University campus, which is nestled in the middle of the mural and surrounded by color, shadows, and space that invites the eye to explore the many parts of the painting.
12 o'clock, we have the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, and then to the right and left of that, the skyline just sort of explodes, and it's a more whimsical, fun rendering that's, you know, partially accurate, partially made up of the Indianapolis skyline, and I think it's pretty recognizably Indy. And then as you move towards the left side of the skyline, it moves into this big road that I kind of think of as Meridian, you know, just sort of, and then that Meridian Street kind of moves and moves right into Butler University. And then it's almost like we're a bird flying over the university. It starts with the Academic Quad and Jordan Hall at the bottom, and then it moves all the way up to the top where you can see Hinkle Fieldhouse on the horizon.
And you did. You talked about it. It reminds me a lot of your original work that a lot of people are familiar with very whimsical. But you've kind of been transgressing away from that a little bit, haven't you?
I have. The last 18 months, I've really transitioned into a traditional plein air painter. And I can honestly say, even 18 months into it, I've never been more addicted to painting. You know, the days that I don't get to paint, I'm a little bit mad about. And, you know, I just want to be outside painting. And so to go back into my older style, where you can really, instead of working from life and realism, I just get to make everything up. It was super fun.
How did you know where to start when you looked at the canvas and you had in your mind what you wanted to do?
At first, I really wasn't quite sure, especially with it being on the ground. Kyle Ragsdale, another Indianapolis artist, actually, he recommended I just start throwing buckets of paint on it, which is exactly what I did. So I mixed up some really thinned down acrylics, and I just, pretty much a gallon at a time, I just threw paint. And what happened was I turned it into, I have a watercolor background. I turned it into almost a giant watercolor. And a lot of that, those initial watery layers, I balanced out the composition. There's really nice parts of opacity where the paint is really built up thick, but then there's also elements where you can really see some of that watercolor and all those unexpected elements that you cannot control that happens with watercolor. Even though it's acrylic, that stuff happened and you can see it. The painting limitations, you know, I worked on it the most of probably 80% of this thing was on the floor, which at first I was not excited about. But once we got it onto the stage at Clues Hall and had it vertical for the first time and I was working in a lift, I realized how massive this thing is. And if I, you know, I wanted to work on Hinkle Fieldhouse, I couldn't just walk over to it. I had to move the lift and then take it up 35 feet. And then, you know, I better have the right paintbrush and paint in the basket or else I'm gonna have to go back. But anyways, I was excited to get it back on the floor so I could just walk all over it. And so if you examine it carefully enough, I did overtly leave one gigantic footprint right in the middle of the thing.
Bining added some other visual treats in the skyline.
In the shadows of the city, the shadows of the buildings are pretty dark. I invited 9 other Indianapolis painters and artists in to help me one evening, and I asked them, you know, roughly to spend a few hours doing just tedious busy work. And as, you know, a thank you, in the shadows of the city, there are original paintings done in their individual styles. So there's in the shadows. So it's up there. There's original Kyle Ragsdale paintings, original Johnny McKees, original Benny Sanders, Kip Norman, Nathan Foxton, Alicia Zanoni, Rich Anderson. You know, even a friend, Sammy Daniel, has a painting up there.
The mural is titled Journey from the Outside In, and Bining encourages visitors to enjoy it from all angles. Up close, far away, and from each of the 4 floors of the Clues lobby.
It was actually my wife recommended that title, and I thought it, at first I was like, I don't know if I like it, but then once it really started setting in, you know, I'm not a Butler alumni. And before this, even though my wife is a Butler alumnus, you know, I really had no connection to the university. But now, you know, I totally do. And in a weird way, I feel like, you know, now Butler is a small part of me, and now, you know, I have a small part in Butler.
Some numbers here. On June the 2nd, he enrolled the canvas. July 31st was his deadline. That was really only about 4 weeks of real time because they had classes and construction going on, so they had to start and stop. He had 19 people to help him, took a total of 60 hours and 103 volunteer hours to complete, but he's very satisfied with it. It'll be hanging on the wall for the next 2 years. Plenty of things to see and do in Clues Hall, so I invite everyone to go take a good look at it.
Well, and I love those statistics for context, too. You can tell his first career was attorney. He knows those weren't all billable hours, right?
Once you're an artist, unfortunately,
they're not billable.
So.
Exactly. Well, we have some other things you can go see and do on our calendar. We call
What'll We Do?
Well, we may know it as a love story, but boy, it has the right title to be performed this month that ends with Halloween, and that is Ghost the Musical. It's on stage now at Beef and Board's Dinner Theater, and this is part of that trend. It used to be that stage plays got made into movies, and now, lots of times, movies are being made into stage plays, and that's what happened with this. So, Ghost at Beef and Boards, and it's actually running through November 18th.
Speaking of Justin Vining, right now he has a collaborative show in the Hoosier Salon up in Carmel, and I got a sneak peek of it, at it the other night, and it's a wonderful display of work of some of the area's 3 most compelling artists, Justin Vining, Kyle Ragsdale, and Benny Sanders. The 3 have been plein air painting together, so you'll get to see their individual works and also some pieces that all 3 of them worked on together, and those are the ones that you really want to go see. The Hoosier Salon is open 5 days a week. You can just drop in right there off of Main Street in Carmel and get a look at Vining, Ragsdale, and Sanders. Need to find more to do? Check out the indiearts.org/guide online at the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Coming up, he's been writing about culture for years, but now Dan Grossman has an even bigger job in arts journalism. But first, The Sorcerer's Apprentice gets into some naughty territory, and it's not what you think. Benny Goodman provides a soundtrack for a saucy peekaboo routine. These are just a couple of features of a show that was so popular during the Indie Fringe Festival that it's being restaged in an expanded form in early November. I invited the show's creator and director, Bob Harbin, to tell us why vaudeville and burlesque are still fun. Okay, so some definitions. Vaudeville and burlesque. Remind us.
What are those
two art forms and why?
Okay.
Why were you attracted to them?
Let me see. Okay. Well, here's the, okay. If you've seen the movie Gypsy.
Yep.
There's wonderful, because when you first see Gypsy Rose Lee do a performance, she's in a hall with like 80 men who are all pretty much in business suits, and they're just yelling and da 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 da. And well, burlesque houses were put up originally for the businessman to be able to leave his job at any given time and go to a club, if you will,
blow off a little steam,
and blow off some, see some body comics tell naughty jokes, mm-hmm. to see some women that were not in very high regard sharing some of their prized possessions, and then they could go back to work. And these burlesque houses would open at, you know, 10 in the morning and be open all day long and into the night. And it was never considered a very high brow form of entertainment. It was always the lowest. You know, any of the performers in that age, and you'll remember Mama Rose, oh, no, we don't do burlesque. Mm-hmm. We don't do scenes. Mm-hmm. They were always aching to be in vaudeville. Vaudeville, think Flo Ziegfeld. Think a show that you was in a respectable theater, many of the houses that are still in New York, mm-hmm. and you would go to an 8 o'clock show, and it would be a spectacular presentation. It wouldn't necessarily be like a musical and have a storyline. It may just be, you know, different acts that were put together. But you would go, and ladies would dress up, and the men would wear their tuxes, and they would go for a wonderful evening of vaudeville. And many of those stars, those were the biggest stars that they had.
Marx Brothers got
absolutely
their start.
Absolutely.
Sophie Tucker. Oh, yeah. Sophie Tucker.
Oh, Al Jolson. All these folk and George Cohen. These people got their beginnings in vaudeville and being a top, you know, a top liner, a headliner, mm-hmm. and your name would be on the marquee. It was the epitome of what you wanted to be. So we thought, why not try to combine the two? Because mm-hmm. I think there's a very definite line. I'm excited this morning, aren't I?
That there's
a very definite line between.
I think you should consider a career in theater.
Oh, honey, I'm ready. And look at me. I have the face and the body for radio. But I think that there's a fine line between sort of nasty and naughty. I love naughty. I think naughty is just with a glint in your eye and usually with good humor, and there's nothing covert about that.
How do you know when you've gone too far? Were there moments when you were putting the show together first for The Fringe last year and then reviving it for this?
We didn't want to do anything that anyone involved with this show would be embarrassed to do.
Okay.
And we didn't want to do anything that would embarrass our audience as well. We have made it, you know, sort of an adults-only kind of show because mm-hmm. God knows a towel may fall at the wrong time, and we all hope it does. But and I think that's – the show was so successful before, and I think maybe that was the secret to it. Everything we do is done with a twinkle in our eye mm-hmm. And in the best of humor, so that if an accident does happen, no one's upset about it. It's almost like, you know, your brother's towel fell and you saw his left cheek or something.
What do they call it? Oh, on the Super Bowl, it's called a wardrobe malfunction.
Exactly. Yeah. We don't have any on-purpose wardrobe malfunctions. but we want people to come in and be able to have a lot of fun and not be embarrassed to be sitting next to someone.
Yeah.
You know, or thinking that, oh, you know, I don't want anyone to know that I'm here. You know, we want you to come. We want you to just have a great time, kick your heels back and enjoy yourself. And all the performers, oi!
You're working with a lot of people you've worked closely with over the years.
Claire Wilcher is just perfection. She sings. She's the funniest in the world. We've got people from professional dance teams. Oh my goodness, Janae Michelle's going to show you more than her mother probably wants her to. and we've got you know boys with towels and. Well, anyway, that's also a point too. The difference between burlesque was pretty much just the body. Vaudeville, we're going to the Sisters Bibb, Rachel and Rihanna, who Rihanna just finished Dreamgirls at Footlight. Mm-hmm. Rachel just finished Sister Act up north at Myers. They are, Mike, you're going to drop in your seat because their voices are so beautiful. So we have amazing singing, amazing dancing. We've got some really funny stuff.
Bob Harbin's theater company, Bob Directs, created I'd Like to See Even More of You. Go see for yourself one weekend only, November 3rd and 4th at Footlight Musicals. Now, you must be at least 18 to attend, and there are primetime and late-night shows. Get the skinny at bobdirects.com, and that's D-I-R-E-X, so bobdirex.com.
And now we know why burlesque is naughty, but vaudeville is accepted in polite society.
Indeed.
You never know what you're going to learn right here on Art of the Matter, do you? This is Jill Dittmeyer with you once again. And in the last year, I've been contributing stories here to the Art of the Matter, and I've met some really fascinating people, like our local performer, composer Tyron Cooper, sociologist, writer Matthew Desmond, painter Justin Vining. You heard about him today. And we hope that you've learned about new people and maybe even tried out some arts events that were new to you based on what we've been telling you thanks to this program. And I bet if you're listening right now, even during a pledge drive, that you actually really appreciate that we take the time to seek out the arts and culture organizations that make our community richer and a lot more fun. So won't you show your appreciation by becoming a member or renewing your membership today? Right now, it's easy. Give us a call, 1-800-233-0020, or go to our safe, secure website. It's WFYI.org.
Jill, you're so right. I'm looking through the speakers right now, and I see that we have with us today some of the most responsible citizens of our virtual WFYI radio community. And by that, I mean you, and you, and oh no, I wouldn't forget you. Thank you for listening to our program and for supporting WFYI Radio. Do make sure you get or stay in the fold. Do it now so you can cross it right off that to-do list. Just call 1-800-233-0020, or you can go to WFYI.org. And stay tuned. There's lots more fun still to come. Before his recent promotion to arts editor at Nouveau, Dan Grossman wrote about arts and culture in our city for the publication for years. Dan sat down with contributor Pete Brown to chat about how he got his start and his observations on Indy's arts history and future.
When I was going back and doing a little bit of research, I went to Nouveau's site, actually, and I searched for Dan Grossman,
uh-huh.
and it pulled up a lot of writing.
Okay.
And then I backwards sorted it, because I wanted to see when was the first time that you had something published on Nouveau that's recorded in, like, the digital age, right? Do you know when that is, off the top of your head?
Off the top of my head, it's probably a story about the art scene in Carmel and the Evan Lurie Gallery.
Hmm.
So at that time, Carmel was kind of new into the art scene, but the opening of the Evan Lurie Gallery 10 years ago now, almost 10 years ago, it was November 2007, it was really impressive to me. I felt like I was walking into an L.A. gallery. They
had
painters like George Santos, very well-known painters like him, and it just seemed like a real change. So I was interested in it, and I was interested in writing about art. So actually I pitched a story to Nouveau about the difference between the Carmel art scene and what was going on in Fountain Square, which was kind of a naive kind of angle in retrospect. But David Hoppe, who was arts editor at the time, he liked what he heard from me about Carmel, so he wanted me to write more, and that was my first art story for Nouveau. I had written for Nouveau before, several times before, but that was the first entry into the art scene.
Interesting. Really. And is that where your background, do you come from the journalistic background and arts background, or what gave you the idea to even approach them in the first place?
Well, I don't have a really strong arts background as far as visual arts, mm-hmm. but what I do have, I graduated in writing seminars from Johns Hopkins University. I've always been interested in visual art.
Sure.
As a way to, say, inspire a poem or something. I've always been writing poetry.
Sure.
So there's kind of a correlation between people who write about art and people who are poets, mm-hmm. I think. But in order to write about art, I had to learn a lot more about visual art, and I kind of began my own education campaign.
So it was a little bit trial by fire almost.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. But I think they liked my writing style because I intentionally tried to connect the art that was going on with what was going on in the community. And that's always been important to me.
Yeah, absolutely. If somebody is new to indie and they're listening to this, or they're not what they would consider themselves, they wouldn't consider themselves an arts person.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hearing you and they're kind of getting fired up to start looking around and start exploring more. What would your top couple of suggestions be to people that are looking to integrate themselves a little more with the arts and cultural scene here in town?
Well, I would say a good entry to that would be the first Friday shows, the shows that galleries coordinate on this first Friday of the month, mm-hmm. to open exhibitions, to have receptions for their artists, and, you know, wine and cheese are served and such. But it's a great opportunity to go out and not only meet the artists, but the administrators of the various nonprofit institutions, like, you know, like I mentioned before, Harrison Center for the Arts, where there are like three or four things going on, maybe four or five exhibitions. There's maybe a music performance.
Yep.
You know, Big Car Collective, that's been one of the big stories of the past 10 years, how they've become involved in the community, and they've moved several times. Most recently, they moved to Garfield Park area, and they always have some interesting things going on. And Gallery 924, all of those guys are integrated into the first Friday scene somehow. So I would say, you know, take a look at that. Take a look at those galleries. I don't know what's going to happen with the Indianapolis Downtown Artists and Dealers Association schedule they had every month.
Right.
Since I'm not sure how long that's going to go on, but, you know, check those websites for those organizations, and you'll definitely find a lot going on.
How do you feel the Circle City Industrial Complex is kind of plugging itself into the arts community?
Oh, good
here?
Question. Yeah, that all has to do a little bit with the decline of Fountain Square as an arts venue.
Mm-hmm.
Like that first story I pitched back in 2007 about comparing Carmel to Fountain Square, things seem to be getting going there.
Yeah.
Big Car had just located a studio gallery space there, and suddenly artists were kind of trickling into Fountain Square. But lately, in the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, things have undergone a shift as, I guess, rents have risen and restaurants and bars have flooded in, and there's not a whole lot of art going on in Fountain Square anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And what's been happening is slowly these artists have been trickling in to the Circle City Industrial Complex, which I believe during World War II they were testing airplane engines for Cummins or something like that. It's been around a long
Amazing.
Time. It's this huge space, and most of the space, I think, is not even occupied at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're working on filling it, but they've got Center Point Brewery there. They've got a lot of artist studios and gallery spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another place, too, to check out during First Fridays. Thank you for mentioning that. So that's the new place right now. You know, whether that will still be the scene in 10 years or something, who knows? I mean, things shift, things change. And Garfield Park is another area to check out too, because a big car locating there and their work in trying to get artist housing in the area as well, and trying to promote the arts and arts communities without promoting gentrification. I think that's what they're trying to do there. So, you know, I'm interested in following that as well.
Contributor Pete Brown with Dan Grossman, arts editor at Nouveau. Read Dan's work at nouveau.net/arts. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here with Chris Nuisance Johnson of the Knott Brothers. They have a new EP out titled Misadventures. Thank you so much for being here, Nuisance.
Yeah, thank you.
Before we jump into your five songs, give us a description of the Knott Brothers.
Man, the Knott Brothers are like those two dudes in the back of the bus that are kind of weird, but they're making a lot of cool sounds, and you know you want to hang out with them. You're hesitant at first, but then once you come back, you're sucked in and you're grooving with us. That's what our music's like.
Been running circles through my brain, and I've been drinking through the pain, and I've been wondering how we got here.
I like that. And these five songs you're sharing with us today, frame it for us.
So some of these songs are like weird songs that like I'd hear in weird places in the world that would stick with me. And other ones are ones that like I was like, that's what music can be. And I should aspire to be like that.
Number one
is a super weird one. It's by The Pillows. It's called Ride on a Shooting Star. It plays at the end of Fooly Cooly, which is an anime. And I remember being like this little ghetto kid in Gary who like watches anime and didn't tell anybody. It feels real weird about how like hype the end song gets me, and it's just like a punk rock song in Japanese.
Number two
is Anamanaguchi, Scott Pilgrim Anthem. That's the name of the song, is Scott Pilgrim Anthem. Name of the group is Anamanaguchi. And it's from the Scott Pilgrim 8-bit beat-em-up game that came out when the movie came out. And I remember like grooving to the song and being like, man, this 8-bit, like they've got, you know, it's not like on a game cartridge. They're really grooving. Say It Ain't So by Weezer. I learned how to, I didn't know about this song until I got the game Rock Band. And then like I was listening to the lyrics when he's like, this bottle of Stevens awakens ancient feelings like father, stepfather, all that. I was like, man, these dudes are like rock and roll, but they're singing about the same kind of stuff that like I deal with. I was like, that's interesting. Turns out people are people.
Somebody's hiding, it's drowning.
Before Lupe Fiasco's Little Weapon, that song gives you a very wide perspective of people and their issues, and he painted from a lot of different angles. The only downside is that last verse about playing video games, which is a dope verse, but it doesn't exactly fit in like what Lupe's dropping. I think he just let his homie drop on it, but it's still a really good song, and like that's one of those ones like, man, this is what you could do with words. That's crazy.
Now Lil Terry got a gun he got from the store. He bought it with the money he got from his chores. He robbed a candy shop, told her lay down on the floor, put the cookies in the bag, take the pennies out the drawer. Look, Khalil got a gun he got from the rebels to kill the infidels and American devils. A bomb on his waist, a mask on his face, prays 5 times a day and listens to heavy metal. Little Alex got a gun he took from his dad that he snuck into school in his black book bag, his black nail polish, black boots and black hat. He gonna blow away the boy.
Fifth and final song, yeah.
Fifth and final, it's one that really shaped me and who I am. And I think once I say it, everybody will kind of get the idea of why. But Walk This Way featuring Run DMC.
Oh, yeah.
I remember the first time I heard that song, and I was like, this is like it. This is rap and rock at the same time. Like, I really dig this. I think more people should know about this. And the music video was dope. They were literally breaking down walls. And that, I had to be super young when I saw it, but it had to change me. It still sits with me today.
There's a backseat lover that's always undercover, and I talk to my daddy.
And let folks know how they can keep up with Knot Brothers online.
You can check Knot Brothers out on Instagram, Facebook, also Twitter, but mainly Facebook. That's the one you're gonna get the most amount of information. That's Knot Brothers with a K, K-N-O-T, like tied in a knot.
Thank you, New Sense. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Pete Brown, Melissa Davis, and Jill Dittmeyer. You can hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, what do fabric artists and engineers have in common? How Dorothy Alleg got her artwork in the Cummins Building, and a giant show and sale of clay-based art. And, of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.